This episode is sponsored in part by Airbnb. You know, Jen and I love trotting around the globe. You gotta trot, you can't gallop or anything. And Airbnbs have become our go-to for a cozy stay wherever we land. So when we finally decided to put down roots and build our own place, we thought, why not sprinkle a bit of that Airbnb magic into our home? We went all out, designed it with a spare bedroom that comes with its own exterior door. This way, our guests can come and go as they please, making check-ins and check-outs a breeze. We've been lucky enough to host folks come into town to visit family and friends. Inspired by our travels, we wanted to make their stay extra special. So we began adding little personal touches here and there, snacks, bottled water, a brochure with our local recommendations that we made, even some cool samples from our show sponsors. It's all about making our guests feel welcomed and cherished. And really, when you think about it, why let your home just sit there gathering dust when it could be your ticket to more incredible adventures? Turning it into an Airbnb not only brings in a little extra cash, but it's also a fantastic way to share a piece of your world with others. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. This episode is sponsored in part by Airbnb. You know, Jen and I love trotting around the globe. You gotta trot, you can't gallop or anything. And Airbnbs have become our go-to for a cozy stay wherever we land. So when we finally decided to put down roots and build our own place, we thought, why not sprinkle a bit of that Airbnb magic into our home? We went all out, designed it with a spare bedroom that comes with its own exterior door. This way, our guests can come and go as they please, making check-ins and check-outs a breeze. We've been lucky enough to host folks come into town to visit family and friends. Inspired by our travels, we wanted to make their stay extra special. So we began adding little personal touches here and there, snacks, bottled water, a brochure with our local recommendations that we made, even some cool samples from our show sponsors. It's all about making our guests feel welcomed and cherished. And really, when you think about it, why let your home just sit there gathering dust when it could be your ticket to more incredible adventures? Turning it into an Airbnb not only brings in a little extra cash, but it's also a fantastic way to share a piece of your world with others. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with my producer, Jason DeFilippo. In today's conversation, we're talking with my friend Jane McGonigal. She's a game designer, future forecaster, and best-selling author of Super Better, which I've just read, among other books, of course. She is a world-renowned designer of alternate reality games, or games that are designed to improve real lives and solve real problems. She writes and speaks about alternate reality games and massive multiplayer online gaming, especially about the way that collective intelligence can be generated and used as a means for improving the quality of human life or working towards the solution of social ills. In 2009, she suffered a debilitating concussion that helped her in the development of a game, Jane the Concussion Slayer. She developed this to treat her concussion and other similar conditions. The game was later renamed Super Better, hence the book. And today, we'll discover how games teach us critical thinking, problem-solving skills, and increase our ability to collaborate, as well as recover from traumatic experiences. We'll also explore the ways that a gameful mindset can boost our motivation, boost our confidence, and our ability to pick up new skills in the face of obstacles. And we'll examine the benefits of something called post-traumatic growth and how that can counterintuitively coexist in tandem with the disadvantages of post-traumatic stress. And we'll identify how developing psychological flexibility can help you conquer phobias, recover from injuries, and achieve what you once thought was impossible. Of course, we've got worksheets for today's episode so you can make sure that you solidify your understanding of all the key takeaways here from Jane. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. And if you want to know how I manage to book all these great people and manage all my relationships using systems, tiny habits, and other little tips and tricks, check out our Level 1 course, which is free. That's over at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. Got a dozen or so videos in there for you to help you get your network on. All right, here's Jane McGonigal. You actually had that crazy concussion happen. So does that have epigenetic repercussions? Does that kind of thing happen? Or is it mostly like smoking and exercise?
Research suggests that there can be long-term consequences to having multiple concussions. I actually had one when I was pretty young. It's actually one of my first memories. I fell off a slide. There was like a, you know, like slides sometimes have bumps. Yeah. And I was just a little too enthusiastic, went right over the side and, you know, knocked out. And apparently, I didn't know it at the time, but that made, if you later get a pretty serious concussion, it can be worse because you've already had one and your brain kind of responds differently the more times you get it. So, yeah, when I'm older, I might have a different brain than my sister, you know, and that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. Well, and with all the games and stuff that you're doing.
Well, that's my That's my like get out of jail free card because I game more and I run more, and that's also really good for the brain. So I may, I think I've like hopefully reversed the long term traumatic effects.
Yeah, there, I actually had a brain scan just from out of curiosity from this guy who's a doctor. You know, I wish I could remember his whole name and I could plug him here, but he shows you these games where if you relax a lot, the dragon flies through the rings or whatever. But it's really interesting stuff. And you did the initial, they do like a baseline thing to see where you start. And he goes, hey, you had a concussion. Do you remember this? And I said, never had a concussion. And he goes, yeah, look, I'll show you on the scan. You hit the back of your head really hard. And he goes, you might have just been like two or three and not remember it. But he's like, there's just dormant, I can't remember the term, but there's kind of like this,
like a kind of plaque.
Plaque.
Yes.
Is it amyloid plaque or something? It's just there and it's in the back of your brain. He goes, you probably have had it for so long that whatever area of the brain that was, you just, your brain kind of adapted. Mm-hmm. And he goes, but we can probably regain some of this if you, you play our cards right. And it's actually a game where you fly either, you can pick dragons, planes, boats, whatever, and just flying around. And I thought, but I've never had a stinking concussion. So I called my mom and she was like, I mean, I can't think of any time when you hit the back of your head. And I said, what if I called the doctor back. I said, what if I hit the front of my head?
Oh, yeah, it reverberates back.
And he goes, yeah, you could have done that. And I was like, oh, I totally jumped off a climber in preschool and just smashed my head. And I fell downstairs. And he's like, oh, yeah, that could easily have done it. And this stuff sticks with you forever.
Yes, it does. Well, that it's so funny. I had exactly the same thing because when I wasn't healing from the concussion that I write about in Superbatter, I was really confounded. My doctor was confounded. She's like, you should be better by now. And, you know, because I didn't think I'd ever had a serious concussion.
Stuff you never want to hear.
And my parents, like 2 months into the healing process, are like, oh, yeah, well, you had a really bad concussion when you were three. And I'm like, wait, what? I mean, I remember falling off a slide and breaking my collarbone, but I didn't know I had a concussion. I'm like, you guys could have mentioned that.
Yeah.
That would have helped in my, you know, planning for how to get through this if I had known.
And was it a concussion in the same part of the brain? Do you happen to know?
No.
No. And that doesn't matter? Your brain just has a different reaction?
I mean, it can matter, but I just, I mean, we know nothing about what happened to my brain in the 1980s.
Of course.
Really, you know.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Because you didn't even, there was no scan. They went, oh, her head doesn't have a hole in it, so we're good there.
No, and they didn't really treat concussions, you know, 20, 30 years ago. It was, I mean, it was like you just went on and the brain will fix itself. Yeah. And the idea that it would come back to haunt you later or, you know, not really something people were thinking about.
So if you've ever had a concussion, lose plenty of sleep over the fact that it's still there. Just dormantly waiting.
I mean, it's okay to acknowledge that there that you may want to do a little bit more for brain health if you have. I think that's important. It's like a little bit anxiety producing.
Sure.
But the reality is you can do things the rest of your life to as the game designer in LA was showing you, you can play games, you can meditate, you can get better sleep. I mean, even just improving your sleep regimen can improve your brain health. And so it's just like, oh yeah, maybe I have a little deficit to make up, but in making it up, you may actually rebound way better just because you're a little bit concerned. Now you're going to have, you know, double, triple better brain health.
Good point. Yeah, it's like those friends of mine in my 20s. I had a couple of buddies and they got some, they're pale and they got melanoma. And they're like, now I'm not eating red meat and I'm going to be vegan and do endurance athletics. And I'm like, you went from normal guy with a mole to super healthy guy because he's like, I don't want to die when I'm 30 from skin cancer. And I'm like running outside and swimming for a long. Never mind. Never mind.
You're it's true. You may. I'm an endurance runner also. Yeah. And the sunscreen it's never enough. I mean, if you're out there for 4 or 5 hours in the sun.
It can be an issue. Now, look, you had the concussion. You weren't getting any better. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting about your story was you were having all these feelings and they were kind of like terrifying. Mm-hmm. And you had to, I don't know if compartmentalize is the right word, but go to the doctor and go, look, I'm having major anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. Is it because I feel, what's going on here?
And it was even worse than that because I was afraid to tell anybody about these thoughts, which were, I mean, it was essentially suicidal ideation. And it doesn't quite start out that way. It starts out with, you're never going to get better. And you're going to live the rest of your life without being able to think clearly or have a normal job or be out of bed for more than a couple hours a day. And then you start trying to imagine your future and you just can't think of anything good that could ever happen to you again. And that sort of slowly becomes, well, if nothing good is going to happen to you again, you're going to be a burden on your husband, and, you know, what's the point? And then it very quickly becomes thoughts of suicide. And this was, it feels sort of rational at the time. And I'm very lucky that because I'm a little bit of a geek and I love science, after my brain was not getting better, I was trying to use, you know, the 1 hour a day that I had a clear head to look for research on concussion recovery. And I found one article, it was probably about a month in, that said that suicidal ideation is a side effect of concussion, because when your brain is trying to heal, it diverts resources, and the part of your brain that is able to anticipate good things happening, right? The part that loves dopamine, right? All your listeners know about. Yeah. You're always trying to like hijack dopamine so you get motivated. That part of the brain's like, no, I don't want you to be motivated because you might go out and hit your head again, and we need to stay in bed and heal.
Right. It's nice and safe and under the blanket.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But when your brain's telling you never get out of bed again, you interpret it as my life is over. I want to die. When I read that this was not something that was a rational feeling, that I was making sense and saying, yep, it makes sense to die, but actually my brain trying to protect me and it was normal and it would go away, I was able to start to wrestle and step away and say, okay, I'm having these feelings. My brain is telling me something, but it's not really me. It's not my true hopes and dreams. And just sit with it. And I had to sit with it for a while. You know, you live with these thoughts, but you learn to separate yourself from them.
Yeah, that can be useful, right? Because then you're looking at like, okay, my brain's a really complicated machine. It's wanting to put me in a kind of timeout or standby. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that we're going to shut down and that's what's good for me. It's just like, calm down. Don't go outside and hit your head again. Relax. Oh, I can't tell you that in a logical way because I'm the emotional part of your brain.
I'm just chemicals.
So what I'm going to do is just make you feel like crap, and then you won't go anywhere, and I can work on the problem at hand.
Yes, and later I learned, obviously I got really interested in brain chemistry. Once your brain breaks, you're like, oh my God, I need to know how it works. And a lot of depression research in the last few years has come to believe that there's a really strong evolutionary advantage to depression. I mean, why would we still have it all these many millennia later?
Right.
And the theory is that we will oftentimes become depressed when our brain figures out before we do that we're putting effort into the wrong area. You know, if you're depressed at your job, it may be because your job actually is not a good job for you. It might be meaningless work and you're putting energy towards something that doesn't matter to you, or it's really not a fair environment and you're never going to get ahead and you should get out while you can. Or if you're studying the wrong thing, or you're putting pressure on yourself to complete a project that in fact doesn't matter. Your brain will make you depressed so that you stop putting so much damn energy and effort into something that is not actually going to help you. And so if you're depressed, one of the things that can really help is to give yourself permission to say, am I putting energy and effort into things that I really don't care about?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think a lot of us look at it from the other way around. We go, oh, well, since I'm depressed, I'm not able to focus on my CPA exam.
Right.
And it's like, no, you're depressed because you're focusing on your CPA exam and you freaking hate accounting.
Yes, yes. And it can be, you might find yourself in a situation where you're being asked to jump through hurdles because that's the way it's done. When I was in graduate school, you have to do a lot of things that are intimidating and high pressure for no good reason. I mean, getting a PhD is not like saving someone's life or flying a plane. It doesn't really matter if you meet this expectation or that expectation, but they put the pressure on you because it's like this hazing that you go through.
Yeah, those feeder courses where they're like, it's graded on a curve. I only give out one A.
Yes.
And everyone's like, you're just deliberately making my life miserable.
Yes,
and he's like, yep, because you have to take this class.
Yes, that's right. And they're trying to, you know, build up your ability to withstand stress or prove that you really want it. And a lot of people get depressed in those situations because they accurately perceive this is not fair and this is not right.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't have to play this game. So it's an interesting hack for when you're depressed. It's okay to say, I'm not going to do this stuff. It's not actually going to help me or help me be happy. And let me find something else that I actually care about, and give yourself permission to step away from, you know, whatever game you think you're supposed to be playing.
Sure. Well, speaking of games, you talk about the concept in Super Better of being gameful or gameful thinking. Can we talk about that a little? What actually is that? What are gameful qualities?
Yeah. So at a neurological level, when we play a game, our brain responds to stress and challenge differently. When we're confronted with a problem that we have to solve, our brain will go into one of two modes. It'll say, I don't know if it's worth the energy or time. I'll let somebody else deal with it. Or we'll say, I'm going to fail. I hate failing. I hate being embarrassed. Blah, run away. Or it says, I might succeed. Let me try. Let me find out. I'm curious to see. It says, you know what? I might learn something even if I fail. And I believe that through failure, I can learn and improve. Now, most of us, when we play games, go into that challenge mindset, that positive mindset. Nobody expects the first time they're playing Fortnite and dropping off the airship to be number one. Right. I mean, some people do, but if they're not, they're still okay with it. They're like, okay, I was out number 50. I'm going to come back in. We naturally go into this mindset when we play games where we have experience since we're born. You know, the first time you play tic-tac-toe, you're like, I don't get it. What am I doing?
So hard.
Yeah. Your whole life, you have firsthand experience being bad at something, not understanding it, and getting better. And so that builds up a certain kind of mindset and confidence. The problem is schools don't necessarily reflect that. If you fail an exam, you don't get to take it again, right?
Tried that. Doesn't work.
Yeah. You know, in real life, we might actually be embarrassed if we try something and we don't succeed the first time. And so the gameful mindset is about basically figuring out how to hack your brain or trick your brain into being the person you already are when you play games and being open to that growth cycle in other contexts where anxiety or shame or fear of failure might stop us. And you don't want to do this in every situation. There are some situations where failure really matters. I don't want like my pilot or surgeon to be like, I'll just learn as I go.
Some people are going to die when I try this, and you just might be one of those people.
Yeah. So we're not always good, but most of us are over anxious or over concerned with failure and not as aware of the opportunities to learn and grow and don't feel that kind of freedom in contexts where we really could.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Jane McGonigal. We'll be right back after this. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. To learn more about our sponsors and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/advertisers. And if you'd be so kind, please drop us a nice rating and review in iTunes or your podcast player of choice. It really helps us out and helps build the show family back up. If you want some tips on how to do that, just head on over to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Now back to our show with Jane McGonigal.
One concept that I loved that you did relate to your concussion was something called post-traumatic growth.
Mm-hmm.
That was new for me. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, anytime I hit trauma, I want post-traumatic growth. It's kind of like a little bit of gasoline on the trauma fire or on the development fire.
Right. And it's not accidental. I mean, there are things you can do if you experience something traumatic to improve your odds of experiencing growth rather than the opposite would be, well, it's actually not the opposite because you can experience post-traumatic stress disorder and still have post-traumatic growth because obviously trauma.
At the same time?
You can be having both at the same time and eventually get out of the stress disorder and into where you're just in a growth position. But having one doesn't mean you'll never have the other.
That's good. Is it like a launch pad? What is post-traumatic growth, really?
There are a few different ways that it's defined, but the most common experience is you give yourself permission to live your life differently. If there were hopes and dreams you had that you put aside, if there was a part of yourself that you were afraid to express or something you've been wanting to say that you've been afraid to say, or a goal in life that you were going to do later, you're going to do it now. It's basically about...
It's like a midlife crisis.
It's like a midlife crisis, but you can have it anytime you want.
Great. Go get it now.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean that you're glad the trauma happened. I mean, one of the things I'll tell you, I had a really tense moment once. I was about to give a talk about Superbetter and my concussion. And the person managing the event said, you know, in a way, this concussion is really the best thing that ever happened to you. Because, look, you went on to make a meaningful game. Yeah. This helped a million people. And I was so mad because...
Yeah, it's a little offensive.
Yeah, because the reality is I'm still traumatized by it. I mean, you won't believe how much of my life I spend holding my hands over my head. Like, literally every time I stand up, I put my hands over my head because I don't hit it on something again. And I miss my old brain. It's not exactly the same brain I used to have. I still have migraines all the time and it messes up my life. And I would rather go back and not have it. That's the reality.
You trade your TED Talk for not having to worry about hitting your head.
I think so. And that's the reality. Most people experience a trauma. You lose a loved one. You witness some terrible violence. you're not grateful for it.
Right.
But you've done the hard work of making meaning out of it, and you found a way to become a stronger version of yourself, and that's the positive side of it. So people who are like, oh, post-traumatic growth, that's so Pollyanna, and it doesn't right. acknowledge the reality of right. suffering. No, you still suffer. It doesn't mean you're happy something bad happened. But there is something, it allows you to live in a way that other people maybe don't give themselves permission to live. And that is a wonderful thing. It is wonderful to be able to say no to things you don't want to do because sure. you just don't care anymore about pleasing other people in the same way.
Right.
You give yourself permission to do, you know, write that book or take that trip. It's great. It's like essentially it's like a near-death experience. Maybe you didn't actually almost die, but you have that ability to live in the moment.
You just get so much new clarity and
yes.
among other things. Can we get the growth without some sort of massively traumatizing PTSD-inducing event?
Yeah. It may not be as profound, but there is something called post-ecstatic growth. It's what they call it in the research literature. And I think a better way to talk about it is challenge by choice, mm-hmm. where you agree to do something that is really going to stress you and test you. And marathon running or triathlons or Ironman, that's probably the most common thing that people do to try to achieve this
sure.
because it breaks down your body, it breaks down your mind. You think you're not going to be able to do it. As having run a marathon myself, I can attest
yeah.
that you really have to break through pain and wrestle with why am I doing this? What are my values? What do I want to represent to the world about myself? So you can pick something really, really hard to do. Writing a book, if it's hard for you, can accomplish a lot of this. Giving yourself any really difficult challenge, even something simple like going vegetarian or going vegan, mm-hmm. Especially if you're going to get, you know, shit from it, from friends and family.
All of your friends and family.
Yeah. And you got to, I mean, even if it's not something you want to do for the rest of your life, just it's almost like a kind of monk training, like, you know, going in the mountains and not speaking. Do a silent retreat for 1 week.
That sounds worse than a marathon, including all the training leading up to the marathon, for sure.
That's actually one of my favorite strength training. I designed a game a while ago around the 24 character strengths. So these are kind of universal strengths that every culture throughout history has admired. It's kind of the deepest side of humanity of what brings out the best in us.
Are these virtues like patience
yeah,
and understanding or something like that?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So things like ability to love and be loved or appreciation of beauty or curiosity or bravery, courage, that sort of thing. And so I designed a series of things you could do to basically test and strengthen these virtues. And determination was my favorite challenge and was the most fun to watch people do. It was literally just don't talk for 24 hours. And
oh my gosh.
So,
I'm just imagining how tough that would actually be for me.
It is. And what's great about challenges like that is it doesn't take time or money to do. And yet it's really, really hard. And it's really going to make you feel amazing if you do it.
My wife's like, why don't you try that right now today after this interview?
But it could backfire on her because then you will never shut up about it. You're going to be like, for the next month, you're going to be like, I am so awesome.
I didn't talk for 24 hours. Remember that, Jen? You remember that?
Yeah.
When I didn't talk for 24 hours?
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be the case for me. What determines whether we actually make it through these either post-ecstatic growth or post-traumatic mm-hmm. growth or whether we just kind of buckle under the pressure?
Oh, I mean,
a lot of things, obviously.
A lot of things. Having one of the most practical ways that you can approach it is a kind of learning mindset or curiosity mindset, looking for one thing that I can learn today or one thing I can get better at today that tends to open you up to new possibilities. So,
is that the challenge versus the threat mindset that you read about?
Yeah, exactly. And it builds hope in the brain because every time you try to learn something, that part of the brain that loves the dopamine fires up and says, hey, I might get good at something. I have created the conditions for a positive outcome, right? So every time, even if you're just trying to learn a foreign word and you're trying to pronounce it correctly, you can pick a language that's really hard for you, like Farsi or Mandarin, You have created the conditions for a positive outcome in your brain. Your brain is going to get some of that dopamine going, and that translates to other things, so that when you are facing obstacles that you're not in control of, it's more likely that those neurological pathways are going to fire back up and say something good could still happen.
That's interesting, because I find that I actually moved my Mandarin Chinese vocab study to the morning. And I was like, oh, it's just a good way to get it out of the way. And sometimes I don't do it, but I always feel better on days when I did it. And some of it's just, yeah, you accomplished something today, but I don't get the same sense of accomplishment if I go for a walk or if I read a chapter in a book. I feel better having knocked out 10, 15 minutes of vocabulary.
Right, because it's probably authentically challenging
for you. It is hard. Yeah, of course. I mean, it's freaking Mandarin.
Yeah.
Of course it's hard.
Yeah. Well, and that's why, I mean, taking a walk, it can be pleasurable, but it's not going to do the same thing for your brain.
Right. I'm not on the same part of the curve of like, this is tough.
Right.
Maybe if I went for a run, it would be.
We keep talking about running. Yeah. I feel like we should do part of this podcast while jogging
running.
Because that's my favorite thing is you can tell, are you running at a good pace, as if you can just barely keep up a conversation is a good training pace. So we could.
I've heard that and I thought, you haven't seen me try to run and talk at the same time. It's really hard for me to do that.
Can I tell you something embarrassing about myself that I'm actually not that embarrassed about? Probably, or I wouldn't say it. But when I train for distance running, I'll often sing along to whatever I'm listening to as a way to make sure I'm not going too fast.
Because interesting.
The further you go, the more you have to make sure you're not just like sprinting out the gate. So when I'm racing, I'll often repeat that habit. So I'm like, you know, it's like mile 20 or whatever. And I'm like blasting out to some, you know, Broadway song. Totally.
Yeah.
I'm like the most annoying person. And somehow I'm actually not that. I kind of like being the most annoying person because I'm like, look, if you were singing, you would be training at
the right
pace.
That's right. Are you on a treadmill or are you outside?
Outside.
Okay. Then you don't have to worry about it. I mean, unless someone's following you, they're not that annoyed.
Yeah, right. if we're running the same pace, you're really going to hate me. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll do the I'd stick to the interview for sure. The challenge versus threat mindset I found really interesting. You also talk about striving for psychological flexibility.
Yes.
What is that?
Okay.
What does that mean?
So, let's look at like one really interesting specific example of not having psychological flexibility. So it turns out if you get an injury, like a back injury or a knee injury, the number one predictor of if it turns into a chronic injury that's going to affect the rest of your life is psychological flexibility or inflexibility, meaning if you avoid things that cause pain or you avoid things that you think are going to make you tired early on during the recovery process, if you basically say, I don't want to feel pain, I don't want to feel exhaustion, I don't want to fail at trying to do something, that's the number one predictor of the injury actually not getting better for the rest of your life. It's not how bad the injury was, how severe it was, how much pain you're in. It's literally the mindset that's the best predictor. And the reason why is that the more you avoid things that are hard for you, the more incapable you become of basically being resilient or staying engaged when things are tough. And so the way that you increase psychological flexibility is by being really clear about your values and making a commitment to do something every day to act in those values, even if I will be in physical pain, even if I will be more tired at the end of the day, even if I might not actually finish or I might fail. You basically have to pick values that matter to you. And it could be something like, I just want to be a great parent, or I want to be adventurous. I want to be of service to others. And whatever it is that matters most to you, like you would want people to say about you on the day that you die, this is what Jordan was at his heart. You make a commitment to do that every day. Whether you're depressed, whether you're anxious, whether you're injured, whether you're sick, you find a way to do it. Even if you can't get out of bed, even if you can't talk, you find one way to do one small thing that is with that, in accordance with that value, and that trains your brain to be so much more resilient when things aren't going your way, and let alone when things are going well. Then you become basically super empowered to do the things that matter to you.
Can you give us an example of what that might be? Like what context we might be in?
Oh, yeah.
Are we sick or injured?
Oh,
or
yeah. Well, even just things that you're afraid of. So for example, I used to have a really bad phobia of flying. And I would...
You don't anymore?
So
got it.
This is why it's a perfect example. I mean, I used to cry and shake every time I would get on a plane.
Oh my gosh.
I would cancel trips the night before because I couldn't handle that negative experience of being anxious. And it was more that feeling of anxiety and dread for 5 hours on the plane or 8 hours on the plane or whatever it was, more than actually being afraid of crashing or something.
Right. It's not rational. You just realize it's going to happen.
I don't want to feel like this for 8 hours. I'm going to feel trapped for 8 hours.
Gosh, the night before, no sleep probably.
Yeah, exactly. Ugh, yeah. Anticipatory anxiety.
Yeah,
they
that's
call
the
it.
Worst.
And so at some point I had to make a decision that I have values in my life that are greater than being comfortable. Okay. This is basically what psychological flexibility means for everyone, that you value something more than being comfortable. And in my case, having adventures and seeing the world, being the kind of person who can say, I have been to South Africa or I have been to Singapore, and being able to share that worldview or being able to go give talks and hopefully try to connect and inspire with people. These are values that matter to me more than being comfortable.
And it's a long boat ride to South Africa.
God, you could not get me on the boat. But that's every day you have. If you're the kind of person who struggles with anxiety or chronic pain, I mean, people who live with chronic pain, they do this every day already. You have to constantly say to yourself, there's something I value more than being comfortable. And people who don't get on the plane or don't try to publish that book or don't apply for that dream job because they don't want to be rejected, it's because they value being comfortable more than pursuing their dreams. And when you put it that way, you can see this is stupid.
Yeah, it's not helping me get where I want to be, for sure.
Yeah, who cares if I'm uncomfortable? That's just your own little, that's just your feelings.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, your feelings that you can either choose one or the other in that, if you're giving yourself that choice.
Or just feel bad for 8 hours.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, like, I'm going to be uncomfortable for 8 hours. It's like having the stomach flu. You feel bad for 8 hours and then it's done and you move on.
Then you're in Europe and it's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. You get on the plane and you're like, I am the person I want to be. I am a person who has adventures and does awesome stuff. And I'm not the person who would rather be comfortable.
Did you find yourself making your trips longer so you could not fly back right away? Because you're like, I want to come back, I have to fly again.
Oh, yeah. Last month I went to Australia for like not even 2 days.
Oh my gosh.
Totally. Well, and it was great. And I ran on my favorite trail, which is like right on the ocean.
Is that near Bondi?
Yeah. One? Oh, yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I'm
like,
good one for me to walk slowly.
I now it's like a goal of mine. Someday we'll both be in Australia and you'll be walking on the trail, practicing the Mandarin vocab. And I'll be like, hey, Jordan, running up that hill.
And I'll be like, I should have done that years ago and have a midlife crisis right away. One thing that I found in the book that I thought was it sounded so hokey, but I tried it in real time on an airplane as well, was the palms up trick.
Yeah.
What is this? Like, what is this? How does it work? How do we use it? Because little simple hacks like this that seem totally BS-y, but actually work are golden somehow. There's only a few of those.
And by the way, I love that you tried it, even though it sounded stupid, because that's the most important thing we can do. And all the guests you have on your show, your listeners, just try it. And if it doesn't work for you, you do the next thing, right? So with palms up, this has to do with evolutionary psychology. It's when you sit with your palms up as opposed to palms down. So like when you're typing, your palms are down. If you turn your palms up for a minute, your brain and your nervous system switch into a mode that better facilitates creative thinking, trusting and being open to other people, hearing information that you might normally not be willing to hear. You kind of have more of an open mind. And that's it. The thinking behind this is that before we even had language, the way that we would communicate to each other that we could be trusted or that we were willing to help was through physical gesture that involved an open palm. So if I'm asking somebody to help me, I might put my arms out, like, help me up, and my palms are up. Or if I'm willing to help somebody, I offer a helping hand, that hand is up. If I want to show you that I don't have a weapon, I show you my open palms. There's a physicality towards showing trust and openness, and it's baked into our neurons and our nervous system. So if you are feeling closed off, whether it's to an idea or to a person, maybe you have social anxiety, maybe you're with a bunch of people that you have, maybe it's a family reunion and you're not feeling like these are the people you want to be around with, you know, you just turn the palms up And you can do this even if right before you listen to a podcast or you're listening to a talk and you're like, you want to really absorb the information. You turn the palms up and it puts your mind and your body in the state where you can be open and receive positive experiences and new information.
That's interesting. And like I said, it sounds so hokey. And I tried it and I was like, oh, if you're a writer and you want to be more creative, just turn your keyboard upside down.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Jane McGonigal. We'll be right back after this. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers is really what keeps us on the air. So to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/advertisers. And we also have an Alexa skill, so you can get inspirational and educational clips from the show in your daily briefing. Just go to jordanharbinger.com/Alexa or search for Jordan Harbinger in the Alexa app. Now let's get back to Jane McGonigal.
I think about game controllers all the time, and I'm like, okay, you know, if I hold a Switch or if I'm holding an Xbox controller, or if I'm gaming on my PC, it actually makes a difference. And that is something long-term for the gaming industry. There is a lot of interest in changing the control device so that the hands aren't like this the whole time.
Really?
Yeah.
Because of carpal tunnel also?
Well, or? I mean, right. And obviously, if you're in esports, you've got the physical trainers to deal with all of that. But just because it actually turns out it's better for our mental and physical health, even just in terms of breathing, when our hands are up rather than down.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you may literally see in the future keyboards, upside down keyboards, even just for offices, although probably we'll all be doing vocal input.
Hopefully
in the future.
By then, for
keyboards,
crying out loud.
We may just get rid of the keyboards. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I always think about interface devices and I'm like, wow, the really limiting factor is not the CPU anymore. You can put everything you need. And in 10 years, something the size of your iPhone that doesn't need a screen or input area could be 10 times, 100 times as powerful and half the size. So we're limited by, oh, we've got to have this giant screen and we have to have an input device that's big enough for our clunky club hands to type on. So eventually they have to sort of figure that out, right? And they were doing things for a while like, oh, this laser projects a keyboard onto a surface. And it's like, kind of a half measure.
Yeah, no, the vocal stuff is really interesting. I mean, I think it's pretty clear we're going to be talking to computers a lot more in the future rather than, you know, tapping them or typing. I'm really interested in how that will change our social dynamics. I mean, it's pretty clear computers will be listening to us wherever
they
we go.
They already are if you have an Amazon Echo in your house.
Yeah, and they'll be in public spaces or shared spaces. You go to a restaurant, you go to an office. Will it change our speech patterns? I'm really curious.
It already has. Have you ever whispered around your Amazon Echo because you don't want it to hear that you said its name?
Yeah.
That's already. And I'm like, this is weird. This thing is not living. I should be able to say whatever I want in my damn house. And it's like, sorry, Jordan, I can't figure out what you mean. And I'm like, oh, God.
But just imagine, like, 20 years from now, people are going to be like, remember when you could just talk? Remember when you could just, walk down the street and talk? That's going to be, and right now we're living through a time of kind of technological regret. You know, Facebook and Twitter are regretting, like, whoops, we invented fake news and, state-sponsored trolling and propaganda bots.
Oh, yeah.
I wish we had, maybe known 10 years ago when we were really launching or scaling, we could have prevented this. This is not too early to be thinking about the, 10 years from now, what are we going to be facing technologically?
Yeah.
I mean, this is sort of my gamer/futurist mindset is gamers can play out a lot more moves in advance maybe than other people, right?
Yeah, good point.
And so trying to bring that gamer mindset to like, whoops, we accidentally destroyed democracy people's civilization. Yeah. So, that's just an accidental benefit of being a gamer is you can kind of
catastrophize better than anyone.
And maybe figure out strategies for not waking up in a future that you would hate to be living
enslaved by robotics. One prediction that I had that was so random, speaking of this, is, if you're saying things around your Amazon Echo, let's say I'm like, oh, you know what? My cousin's coming and he's going to be here for Christmas. We should get him a new camera. And then that thing's just listening, right? And then suddenly
we're shopping online, all these camera ads are popping up. Yeah. And it's like, oh, whoops. Or what if we share a computer? And then he's like, why are all these camera ads pop? Oh, I bet this is what I'm getting. Your kids are going to be able to figure this out. Like, my parents must have really been talking about where we're going to go on our surprise trip, because all of this stuff for Bali is now popping up everywhere.
Right. So, okay, the tech companies are already gaming that out.
For sure.
And they're developing basically silos of information, so they can already recognize different family members. So if you don't want your kids to know that you're actually asking it about Disneyland, they can start to basically hide information from family members. And so that's something that I've been thinking about. Like, what transparency levels do you want to set? Like, children's voices? No, I want to know everything that they're searching for.
Exactly.
Spousal, will I pretend that, you know, I'm letting like full transparency or not?
Hey, Alexa, don't tell my wife about my porn addiction.
Well, I mean, that is going to be one of the really interesting challenges for, does our assistant become our accomplice in a way?
And definitely.
if it's the same assistant for, I mean, do you trust your? There's going to be a lot of emotional baggage around this
Alexa,
technology.
Tell me what Jen was searching for. Jordan, you know, don't put me in this position.
How does Alexa know who to help? It's like a real, who will embed the code in the AI that says, I will help this person and not this person? I mean, somebody is writing code that will determine the ethics of your assistant.
So weird. Like, I pay the electric bill. Yeah, but it's her house. Yeah, but I'm the one that bought you. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm already purchased.
That's what I'm saying. How does it prioritize?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, oh, I'm already here and I have power for the rest of the month. You know, who could realistically throw me away and get away with it? That's what I want to know.
It's coming.
Right?
It's coming.
That's so bizarre. Gosh, that's so strange. That was quite the tangent. I definitely want to. Okay, let's talk about pain. Speaking of cheerful subjects and dystopian futures, I thought it was really fascinating that virtual reality can, I don't want to say cure pain because it's not really doing that, sort of distract us well enough from pain, more so than, it's like better placebo than drug?
Or
What are the words I'm searching for here?
Yeah, and I'm so glad you used the word distraction, because the reason why virtual reality is a breakthrough for pain treatment is that it's not just distraction. It actually prevents the brain from experiencing pain. So most distraction techniques, the pain is there and you have to just try to ignore it. But virtual reality hijacks enough blood flow in your brain to literally prevent blood flowing to the regions that normally receive information from your body to say, like, am I on fire or not?
Yeah.
So it actually stops the pain from happening, which is unlike any medication. It's not how we treat pain with pharmaceuticals, and it's not how we try to, you know, distract ourselves. And since I wrote about virtual reality for pain in my book, and I wrote about some of the early studies that found that it actually relieved pain more effectively than morphine for burn survivors. Right. It's super crazy. This field has just exploded. Hospitals are using it regularly. Insurance companies are trying to get VR to people who've been in painful accidents so that they can reduce the amount of opiate prescriptions, because an insurance company does not want you getting addicted to opiates. So everybody's getting involved, from doctors to insurers, and the results are really profound. I haven't been more excited about anything in games or technology than I have specifically about this, because I think we are going to see a massive reduction in the need for pain medication. And it sounds, I mean, if you were given a choice, you know, do I want VR or pain drugs? You might say, no, I want the drugs.
I want both.
Right. Well, and you can get both. I mean, you do get both. You just get less drugs.
Sure.
You need a lower dose, or you need it for a less extended period. So you do get some drugs. But you have to try it to see that it works. And people who see that it works, they're like, great, I don't have the side effects of the medication. I don't have to worry about, you know, getting addicted. It's super exciting.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that running around with an Oculus on or whatever, sitting in a
lying in your bed.
while someone's replacing burn bandages and me throwing virtual snowballs at virtual snowmen that are laughing and jumping around or whatever's going on in this VR world is more potent than me slamming morphine and Tylenol 800 and watching some cartoons or something like that. I remember, you probably know Dan Ariely, right?
Of course.
And he told me in person about how his burn bandage treatment was, and it was just like the most horrifying.
Yeah. It is literally considered the most painful condition a person can suffer. there is nothing on the pain scale greater than it. And that's so testing VR on that is basically if it works for that, it can work for anything. And the thing that's interesting is like, obviously, most people don't go through that level of pain.
Sure.
But the kind of aha moment is that you can control where blood flows in your brain that will profoundly affect your experience day to day, whether it's your appetite or your cravings or your emotions, that you are more in charge of what you're actually feeling than you might have realized. And, you know, if you're not into VR, even a game like Tetris or Candy Crush Saga has been studied that you can basically shut off cravings for junk food, or if you're trying to quit smoking or drink less, whatever you're trying to avoid, even porn, you can divert.
I like how you looked right at me when you said that.
Jordan, I'll leave that to you, what your vices are.
Yeah, that's right.
But you can divert resources from the part of the brain that visualizes. So like, we get addicted to things because we visualize them. And when we have that really immersive picture in our mind of what we want, then we like almost can't stop ourselves from going and getting it. So when you basically hijack that part of the brain to visualize falling puzzle pieces or swapping candies, you have decided that you can control what your brain wants. And it's kind of amazing. So whether you're in pain, you're trying to change a habit, these games give you the chance to control your brain.
It's really nuts that an Oculus, I think, is like $600, and then you plug it into a computer. Pretty soon it's going to be $100 and you won't need the computer because it'll be inside the Oculus, 10.0 or whatever.
And your employer is going to be giving it to you, or your college is going to be giving it to you. I mean, everyone's they're going to be giving away VR headsets because it's going to be such a good way to help people's mental and physical health that, I mean, somebody's just going to give it to you.
Epic battle brewing between big pharma then and tech companies.
But they are, in fact, one of the biggest studies right now, it's a pharmaceutical company and an insurer and a hospital all working together. I think the pharmaceutical companies are going to pivot. They're going to start investing in prescribable technologies.
Sure. Yeah, we're going to see some like, why did GlaxoWelcome or whatever it's called, GlaxoSmithKline, buy this VR game company out of Palo Alto? Like, what the hell's going on? And that's what's going on.
That's right.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's good news.
It is.
Because with the opiate stuff, that stuff is a nightmare. Is this something we can sort of harness now? Like, can I carry my phone with a version of Candy Crush or Tetris on it, and whenever I'm like, oh, I really want a cigarette or something, I can just go, let's just do a couple Tetris levels and see if I still want it.
Yeah. Literally, you can do that for 10 minutes, and the repeated trials have shown that it lowers your cravings by about 25%, which may not sound like, wow, I'm
superhuman.
Might
be the bar you need to not go out and smoke.
That is the bar that changes behavior. And so basically, it gives you a 50-50 chance compared to what if you would normally 100% of the time do it. Now you're doing it half as often. And when you start to do things half as often, then you actually start to wrestle control back from your stupid dopamine system that fires every time you see a thing or hear a thing. So it gives you that fighting chance. And I always do my PSA for putting Tetris or Candy Crush on your phone, because there have been 3 randomized controlled and now a clinical study showing that if you play Tetris within 24 hours of experiencing a trauma, you can prevent flashbacks to the trauma, which is the hardest to treat symptom of PTSD. And people are like, oh, I'll kind of file it away, but you should put it on your phone, because if something bad happens, you want to have it. And I work with EMT groups, who first arrivals on accidents or traumatic, and they're starting to introduce this into the sort of first treatment. And I hear from people who've survived school shootings or were in really traumatic car accidents. They've witnessed physically terrible things you would not want stuck in your brain. And they use this. And if you have it on your phone, that's going to help you.
Because you carry that in your pocket.
Yes. Yeah. And you're not going to be thinking like, let me open the app store and get a thing.
We at Advanced Human Dynamics, which is our training wing, we train a lot of special forces guys, and they do a lot of gaming in Djibouti or wherever, because they have electricity and running water, not a whole hell of a lot else going on. So they've got Xbox and stuff there.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's a difference. And are there any studies on this?
Yeah.
Is there any study that says, hey, when you play Xbox after you go and take down Osama bin Laden, are you a little bit mentally healthier because of it?
There's an amazing study on this. So one of the things people like me obviously care about is there a tipping point when you're gaming too much? You're not getting right. the positive effects anymore. Now it's starting to affect you negatively. Yeah. And every study that's looked at this has found that when you start to get over 20 hours of gaming a week, you start to lose some of the benefits and get some of the positive effects, except for people who are serving in the military and are serving in theaters of war. They can game up to 40 hours a week, and they every hour they game, they improve all of their mental health and long-term sort of return to home. So they're less likely to experience PTSD. The more they game while they're serving, they are less likely to participate in domestic violence when they come home, less likely to have drug addiction, depression, anxiety, and they get more benefit the more they game up to 40 hours.
That's so crazy.
And it's just because it's such a stressful situation yeah. that the ability to control your brain, not create the flashbacks, not experience the physiological, the cortisol that just changes your brain yeah. when you're totally jacked up all the time on cortisol. So that's actually been studied that they can actually gain more than the rest of us
yeah.
and benefit.
Well, they've earned it, I suppose,
mm-hmm.
if they're yeah. dealing with that. And what's even better about this is this probably isn't one of those BS like cigarette company studies where they're like, well, Bungie paid for this study to show that video games are good for you.
They're
selling these games anyway.
It was actually right? a military study. It was a long-term military study. I was given it by a general, actually shared it with me when I was doing research for Reality's Broken. And they were actually confused that they found that the single most effective thing for improving mental health and resilience and returning home was either gaming for 40 hours a week or being in the gym for almost 40 hours a week. Those were the two.
So you basically have to get obsessed with some kind of progressive.
Yeah, that's right.
Something or
yep.
a skill,
yep.
if you will.
Exactly.
Wow.
Mm.
Yeah. What if you do like 20 hours of gym and 20 hours of gaming?
I think that would both be effective, and you would probably look and feel better.
Yeah, probably. I mean, 40 hours of gaming, when I look at somebody yeah. who probably spends that much time gaming, I'm not thinking that dude is jacked.
Yeah, probably not.
No. That's so interesting. The Tetris technique, I think, if you haven't coined that yet, is really so it's really a great thing because it's free
dollar. Yeah.
And you have it in your pocket all the time. And playing 10 minutes of a game after a stressful event, all you really have to do is remember to distract yourself
yes.
with a video game.
Yeah. And it helps a little bit more if you also try to sleep less the night after trauma, because it's that first sleep cycle that allows your brain to lock in the specifics of the memory and the intense visual specifics. And as somebody who suffered flashbacks from my accident that had the concussion, and I would wake up in the middle of the night convinced that it had happened again, I would, I'd wake up with my husband and be like, I know I just hit my head again. Like I was so realistic. If you can prevent that with 10 minutes of a free game on a phone,
yeah.
somebody's quality of life can be transformed. And so even if it sounds stupid, I mean,
this is like penicillin.
It's such a small thing to do. And when it works, you have saved somebody years of emotional distress.
Do you mind if I ask you how you got the concussion in the first place?
You should never ask somebody that, because it's interesting. I start having more flashbacks when I talk about it.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
That's why I said, can I ask? And I was like, probably.
Yeah. No, that's another good PSA. And I've learned now when somebody like rolls up and they're on crutches and I'm like,
what'd you
do
to yourself?
What happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have learned now that that is actually can re-traumatize somebody and make them more likely to experience PTSD.
That question? What do you think?
I think it's a good question to ask and say, no, I choose not to answer that, because then people can learn like, oh, from now on, I'm totally not going to ask people to because, somebody who's on crutches or whatever,
sure.
they've been asked that by 100 people, 100 times replaying.
Oh, I broke my leg. You didn't notice?
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's kind of like asking when I was in my 20s or something, I'd always, I don't know how I didn't learn this earlier. You'd be like, oh, how old are you? And women are like, I'm in my 30s. And it's like, never ask a woman how old she is. What's wrong with you, knucklehead? It took me a long time to learn that for some reason. And it's like, oh, yeah, people don't like talking about that. And now that I'm 38, I'm like, I don't love the discussion about getting older, because
yeah.
I'm still young, but it's like, that's quickly coming to an end.
Well, research suggests we kind of fix ourselves at age 28 in our mind, and most people tend to see themselves as a 28-year-old version forever, and I think that's totally fine.
It is, unless you're delusional. Well, like, oh, I'm good. I can eat this.
I'm going to be delusional. I plan to act like I'm 28 for the rest of my life.
Yeah. You have. Yeah. Who am I to stop you? The Tetris technique also works for things like cravings, right?
Yeah.
Junk food and things like that, which I think that's important because a lot of people go, like you said, oh, I'll file that in case I ever get in a super traumatizing train wreck. But it could just be, hey, maybe you shouldn't have that third donut, buddy.
Yeah. Okay. So literally anything you don't want to do, maybe you're like really pissed off at somebody and you want to leave a really angry comment on their Facebook page or you want to write an email that you might regret later, you can do it then. Anything that kind of takes you out of the moment and gets you away from whatever scene you're playing in your mind that's really getting you aggravated. So basically anytime you want to control your thoughts or behaviors, right, you play the game for 5 or 10 minutes. There's actually a kind of reverse side of this too, which is if you are procrastinating and you're trying to like motivate yourself to do something, this sounds really counterintuitive. Oh, you should play a video game for 5 or 10 minutes when you're procrastinating. That sounds like a terrible idea.
Yeah.
But actually, if you play a specific type of game, which is something that you're not great at yet. So this is like, don't do a Sudoku puzzle if you're like the master. Open a game that you haven't played before, or open something that's still pretty hard for you, or a level you're stuck on. Do it for 5 or 10 minutes. And that actually will change your physical energy levels and your mental focus and attention because you've now engaged with something that's a little bit hard for you. It's like, it's kind of like doing, you know, 20 push-ups before you want to take a photo showing your biceps.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Not that I ever do that. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking
about. Yeah, it primes your brain. It gets the blood flowing the right ways. And then you turn your attention. So you set a timer. And when the timer goes off, you put the game away. You know, let the round finish or whatever. And then turn your
attention. Don't not finish the level. Come on.
Yeah. No. Don't leave. If you're playing a game, don't leave it hanging. Yeah. And then you turn your attention to whatever was hard for you or you were avoiding. It is, I mean, if you just try it, you'll see. This is incredibly effective. And I do it all the time when I've been putting off some work thing or I don't want to write this email or whatever it is. I just do the game for 5 or 10 minutes. And not only is it like, cool, I've tried a new game. I know something new, then my brain is in the right spot to be like, yeah, I'm engaged. I'm not avoiding. I'm engaging.
If games work for cravings, obviously anger management or whatever with your email and pain, do they work for anxiety too?
Oh, yeah. Anxiety is one of the best use cases for games. So, and there are a couple of things. A lot of anxiety is physiological. And then we make up a story afterwards. So somebody will say, I get panic attacks when I'm in a social situation. I have social anxiety.
Sure.
It turns out now we know that most panic attacks occur in people who are more sensitive to changing carbon dioxide levels. So the reason why you get panic attacks in, you know, social situations or crowded spaces. Yes. It's not because you are scared of being on a plane or you have social anxiety. It's because there's less oxygen relative to carbon dioxide. Yeah, this is another PSA because so many people think that they have anxiety when what they really have is a brain that's sensitive to carbon dioxide.
And that's crazy. And I've never heard that before.
And my brain became more sensitive to carbon dioxide after my concussion. So this is something I had to learn I actually had to go to the hospital once from a panic attack. And once I learned that it's an oxygen thing and not an anxiety thing, what you can do is get more oxygen if you can.
Sure.
But do an activity that regulates your breathing. So video game play is a really good way to regulate breathing. We breathe very regularly when we play. There have been all kinds of studies where they put these breathing measuring devices on people. And the rate at which we inhale and exhale, it starts to approach the rhythm that we naturally do when we are calm. Even if we're engaged in a high-stress game, especially if we're good at it, we go into a very controlled mode.
Like flow state kind
of deal? Yeah, exactly. And we're not going to hyperventilate because we know we need our resources.
Sure.
And
pushing all these buttons. I need max oxygen.
You know that gaming can actually be stressful, right?
Sure, yeah. I was playing Far Cry 5 yesterday and my heart was going crazy.
Yeah. But so, right, and your body's like, how can I control this stress? When you're in a game, you actually control stress very effectively. Or you could play a soothing game. You know, there's all kinds of like Zen games and you're pushing balls around. But You can actually control your breathing with the game, which will change the underlying physiology of anxiety. Because for most people, anxiety starts with chemical experience. It's not that you are actually scared of something. Now, you may actually be scared of something, and then it works by just preventing you from thinking about it, from ruminating about it. I mean, I think people, you know, may actually be scared of certain things. That's fine.
Sure, yeah.
But you want to prevent yourself from visualizing it. The more you visualize it, the more your brain learns that it's scary. Because
just reinforces.
Yes. Yeah. So you just, in that case, it is a matter of distraction. It stops you from ruminating. So it's, games are great for anxiety. And the best thing about all of these techniques is you just build your confidence in your ability to control your thoughts and feelings. And when you realize that you can control them, everything gets easier. You have less anxiety about being in situations outside your control because you know that you have tools that you can use.
Right. And it removes a lot of that emotional baggage of like, I'm always going to be scared when I get on an airplane. It's never going to get better. It's going to negatively affect my career and I can't go to Disneyland with my kids.
Yeah. I do think we're living in an era where people over-identify with mental health challenges, where we say, I'm somebody with depression or I'm somebody with anxiety. In reality, we all go through cycles of these feelings, and some of us, our brains get stuck or our bodies get stuck, but you still have control, and you will not necessarily be somebody with depression or with anxiety your entire life. And we can separate from that. It makes it easier to, I think, to tackle it effectively.
Yeah, move on from it, especially. If games can help sync our breathing, I know you've mentioned some relationship strengthening through other types of synchronization. What's going on here with the gaming and our relationships?
Yeah. When we play a game with somebody else, especially if we're in the same physical environment, so this is great for esports where you're actually sitting with your team members competing, or if you're just at home with friends or family playing a multiplayer game in person, all these sorts of weird synchronization effects start to happen. Your heart rates converge on the same beats per minute. Your breathing rates converge. Posture will start to mirror each other. Facial expressions, electrical activity in the brain will start to look very similar. If you hook people up, you'll see very similar electrical patterns. And this is interesting for two reasons. You're like, why does this happen? That's kind of interesting. And then more importantly, what happens when you've gone through this kind of mind-body merge with somebody? And maybe we'll just start with the impact, because like, why does this matter? When you have synchronized with somebody in sort of mind and body way, you observe it. You don't know that you've observed it, but your brain knows. Constantly at a subconscious level looking at other people's, like, I mean, you may not realize that you are observing somebody's chest for how they're breathing. You're observing their posture and the little muscles in their face to see how they're feeling, because we're constantly trying to figure out, is this person like me or are they different from me? Can I relate to them? Do they mean to do me harm or do they mean to help me? When you're gaming, you start building up all of these positive beliefs about the other person. They're like me because our bodies and brains are doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And I can trust them, therefore, and I have something in common with them. And so we start to like each other more. We're more likely to help a person. We have more empathy for them. It just builds such a positive foundation, and it persists after the game because we've used the game to build a belief about the other person.
Does it matter if we're playing against the person or co-op with the person?
It does not matter.
Really?
That is the greatest thing. If you're playing in person, it does not matter. If you're playing online, it actually does matter because you have fewer cues. Maybe you have vocal cues if you're playing with
a headset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But particularly when we compete against strangers online, then we don't see these effects because it's a more of a dehumanizing process. Mm-hmm. You're not seeing their face. You're not seeing their body language. You don't think of them as a real person. You probably will never see them in real life. So it doesn't matter.
It's a 12-year-old kid who lives in Saudi Arabia.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Who just owned you.
So that's not going to be as good for your relationships. It's really more about in person, or if you've got the headsets on and you're playing with people you know in real life, that's where you get the benefits. And it does not matter if you're trying to destroy them or you're on the same team, because when you're trying to beat someone in a game, you're still actually trying to emulate what's going on in their mind. Like, I have to figure out what you're going to do before do it.
Sure.
So my brain starts trying to act like I think you're thinking and feeling. And that's why we get the brain synchronization, is our brains are basically running simulations of each other. They're trying to get inside each other's heads, which is super cool.
So, yeah, that is cool. That's that neural coupling concept or something.
Yeah. Right? And so that's the why. That's the why you sync up, is that you're basically trying to get inside someone else's brain. And when you try to understand somebody better, then your body and brain start to mimic them so that you can feel what they're feeling and see what they're seeing.
Huh.
And yeah.
If we play video games with our kids, or maybe if they're not getting along and we give them games to play with each other, is that kind of, am I doing something right here? I'm trying to be the laziest parent possible.
Oh my god!
Possible.
Yeah, like if your kids are fighting, make them play a game together, even if they're trying like against each other. Like, channel that negative energy. And also, this has been shown to be really effective for kids with autism. So it can create a positive connection with people in a very structured environment. And studies have shown that kids with autism will do more physical touching with people after they played a video game with them. They're more open to high fives and hugs. They'll do more positive facial expressions after, more likely to give each other compliments. And so a lot of the things that can sometimes be hard become easier after a game. So there's lots of use cases and different types of people who can benefit from this.
Well, in Super Better, you tell the story of how it was some woman who had gotten married outside of her culture, and then mm-hmm. they started playing Farmville or something.
I know. That was so great. I mean, I love what I do for a living. I get to go give talks about this research, and then people will come up to me and share their stories. And this was a case of a couple marrying outside of their religion, and the in-laws hated each other, and it was really driving their family apart. They wouldn't talk to each other. And then one day, you know, someone's mother started doing a co-op mission with the mother-in-law. And I mean, this is at the height of Farmville, where at the height of Farmville, 1 in 12 people on the planet were playing this game. I mean, it was a big connector for humanity.
That's crazy.
Even if it was like not the greatest game of all time, it was one of the greatest, I think, up until Pokemon Go, maybe the greatest connector.
Sure.
I mean, even more than religion, you have more people in common with a video game. When you think about it, it's kind of crazy. Anyway, they started doing co-op missions in Farmville, and suddenly they acknowledged that the other person was not a terrible stranger, but somebody they had something in common with and they could help. And then they started leaving comments on each other's page and liking each other's posts. And then the whole thing just melted and they were a family. And it's
crazy. It's a catalyst for something that important.
Yeah. But I mean, there has to be a reason why games have been important to humanity since humanity existed, right? Like, there has to be a reason that you can go back and dig up any archaeological site and you find dice made out of sheep's knuckles and you find these ancient game boards from thousands of years ago. I mean, there's a reason why we have always played games. It powerfully changes how we relate to each other and how we feel.
They're going to find an Xbox fossilized.
Right. Like 10,000 years from now, they'll be like, wow, look at those like ancient, you know, really ridiculous humans who had no technology and they had these little computers.
Controllers that they were playing with. Why don't they have upside down controllers?
Right, they were still using their hands instead of just their minds.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I think that's so interesting. I love that Farmville saved a marriage from like a grape collecting mission or whatever you do in Farmville. I've never actually played. I was one of the other people in the world who wasn't playing
But you were
Farmville.
Seeing it in your feed.
You couldn't escape it.
Okay, can I just say, this is like for people who pride themselves on not playing the games that everyone else is playing.
Yeah.
If there's like one habit you wanted to change as an experiment, it would be go play the game that everyone else is playing, because it's amazing when you... So like right now, like anybody who hasn't tried Fortnite... You have to.
It looks hard.
Okay, but it's so much fun when you fail that it like doesn't even matter. Okay. And you get to start the next game immediately. It's like literally you get shot. It's like, okay, see you later. I'm going to jump out of the airship again and try again. And the game's, you know, if you're bad at it, the games only take a few minutes. So, you know,
That's true.
Back in.
Because probably like Halo, if you're not good at it, you just keep getting killed. You can't even do anything.
No. Fortnite is actually still fun even when you're bad at it, because you can adopt strategies. You can, you know, go as far away from civilization as you can and at least spend a few minutes like looking around and like before everybody converges and kills you. It's still fun. But it's amazing to be playing the same game as 100 million other people. Or in the case of Pokemon Go, I mean, it was like 500 million people playing this game. When else are you going to have something in common with that many people?
Where were you geographically during the Pokemon Go insanity?
I was in Berkeley.
Okay, because I had a trip to New York.
Oh.
And I remember being on 5th and whatever near Central Park, like 59th or something. and there were so many people. And something happened where, like, a rare Pokemon
Snorlax
or something
is popping up. Yeah.
Popped
everybody
up.
Running.
And the streets got flooded with humans. And I was like, how did no one die right now? I mean, it was in the middle of traffic. And I thought, no, Elton John's over there. It can't be Pokemon.
It's
got to
be
Lady Gaga. Because there were thousands of people all sprinting, screaming, running. I wasn't. I was not.
That's
I know.
Why you
I felt left
it
out.
Negatively. So
I felt super left out. Oh, it wasn't negative. It was just insane. I just felt really left out.
I mean, when you see all of these people converge and you... So this is... Pokemon Go was amazing. Mm. They made some design decisions that, like, nobody had made before that allowed this to happen. One of which was... It was not a zero-sum game in the sense that if there's a Snorlax on this corner, we all can get it. So suddenly these like 100 people running towards the corner, you can high-five them. You can be like, yeah, did you get it? And you can actually celebrate each other's success instead of, you know, feeling like, oh, I have to hoard everything for myself. Right. Boy, did that make it fun to be out and to know, to be able to ask anybody, like, what have you seen here? What's like, what's hanging around? Where can I go to find this particular creature? To have that ability to talk to strangers. I talked to so many people who were younger than me, people who were cooler than me that I would never think I could talk to, like just some really cool teens and be like, what are you catching? I mean, that
it's the only thing you could possibly relate on with some of these people. Probably.
I think so. It was like kind of a utopian. That was like, I feel like that was our summer of love. Like, you know, like 1968, 1969, San Francisco.
There'll be more of that though, for sure.
Yeah. But I think for a lot of people, we will look back at the Pokemon Go summer as like this really utopian. Not, I mean, that was a love fest.
There was a lot. Yeah. There were a lot of people roaming around. Adults, old people, children with
getting
their parents.
In shape.
Oh, yeah.
Getting
there
healthier.
You go.
Getting sunshine and fresh air. I mean, it was like all these like positive. And did you, I don't know if you know this, Microsoft Research did a study of that summer, and they found that in the United States, they had increased the life expectancy by millions of years for the people who are alive in 2016, that we are, as a population, going to live millions of years longer just because of what in the U.S., I think it was almost 100 million people. What those 100 million people did that summer will change how long they live and will change at a population level for the whole country how long
there's
we live.
There's a ripple effect from freaking Pokemon Go that is going to ripple into the next, like, 5 decades.
Yep.
That's insane.
Isn't it? It's super cool.
That's really cool. I wonder, can they find health data, accelerometer data, Fitbit data, and go, wow, that summer we had 58 billion.
That's how they tracked it.
That's how
they
did it. Okay.
They combined data from people who had the game installed on their phone and also had step trackers and other fitness trackers installed on their phone and they correlated and cross compared the data and found that the average Pokemon Go player took 50% more steps that summer than they were in a comparable period.
Wow.
So
I'm surprised it's only that much because honestly, people were. I mean, it was crazy.
Well, think about it this way. So people who already are using a fitness tracker are already engaged with fitness. For people who weren't engaged in fitness, we were seeing 3 times, 4 times as much physical activity. Yeah.
I couldn't even ride on my bike trail because there's a bridge that's about 2 bikes wide and it has 800 people on it trying to catch water Pokemon.
Aww.
And I'm like, can you guys at least take your headphones off so that I don't hit one of you?
Aww.
Yeah.
Well, all you had to do was be like, hey, you guys.
There's a Snorlax in the park.
That way.
Yeah.
Clears the road.
I didn't think
had to
that.
Use your strategy.
Yeah. See, if I'd been playing Pokemon Go, I would have freaking known that.
You could have manipulated hundreds of people.
That's right. Social engineering via augmented reality.
Yeah.
There's so many other questions. We could do this for another hour. And I think I'm halfway through some of my notes. So I really appreciate your time. We'll have to have you back sometime.
I would love that. And have me back with my sister. We could do your first. Have you ever had identical twins on your show at the same time?
I don't think that I have.
We should do it.
There we go. I'll take you up on that.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Great big thank you to Jane McGonigal. The book title is Super Better. All her books are great, though. I really recommend it. I thought this episode was fascinating. I could have recorded for another hour, but again, you know, I want to keep it concise as possible for you guys. We'll have to have Jane back at some point on the show.
Along with her twin sister. That should be fun.
She did offer that. Yeah, we're going to try to make that happen. So stay tuned for Kelly McGonigal as well. And if you want to know how I managed to book all these great people and manage my relationships using systems, using tiny habits, check out our Level 1 course, which is free. That's over at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. And a lot of people say, yeah, I'm going to do that later. That's fine. I'm on it. It's on my list. The problem with procrastinating or kicking the can down the road here, you can't make up for lost time when it comes to relationships and networking. The number one mistake I see people make with this, especially business owners and people who are really busy, postponing, not digging in, not digging the well before they get thirsty. Once you need those relationships, you are way too late. And I know, you don't have time. These drills are designed to take a few minutes per day, 4 to 5 minutes, literally. This is the type of habit that you can really only ignore at your own peril. And I wish I knew this stuff 10, 15 years ago. It is not fluff. It is crucial. And you can find all of that at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. And it's freaking free. So quit crying already and go do it. advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. Speaking of building relationships, tell me your number one takeaway here from Jane McGonigal. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. I'm doing a lot on Instagram these days. I post little previews of the show, do little videos, take some questions and stuff here and there. And don't forget, if you want to apply everything that you heard here from Jane, make sure you go grab the worksheets also in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. This episode was produced and edited by Jason Game Over Man DeFilippo, show notes by Robert Fogarty. I got help with prep from Eric Rausch and Kelly Inazuka today. Thanks for that, guys. And of course, worksheets by Caleb Bacon, booking, back office, and last minute miracles by Jen Harbinger. I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. The fee for this show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful, which should be in every episode. So please share the show with those you love and even those you don't. Lots more in the pipeline. We're very excited to bring it to you. And in the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time.